Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started.
Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I am delighted to introduce you to today's guest, Kevin Lee, digital marketing pioneer, author, philanthropist, and the mind behind DidIt, one of New York's top marketing agencies. He built tech before Google was born, turned an SEO startup into a full services powerhouse, written 4 books, raised millions for nonprofits, including Giving Forward, proving that marketing can drive both profits and purpose. Kevin, welcome. Let's dive in.
Oh, thanks for having me, Alex.
So, Kevin, whenever I meet somebody who is building new products, running an agency, running nonprofit activities, multiple, running your own podcast for e-marketing organization, tell me, how do you combine it all? What's your secret? Where do you get the energy and where do you get the resources to do all of this?
Well, the energy is just boundless because I enjoy every minute of what I get to do every day. I guess in the same way that actors and musicians feel blessed to be able to do what they do every day, I feel blessed to be able to run businesses and get engaged in marketing of various types. And of course, if philanthropy,
you're the master of marketing, is how I should have introduced you, right?
Well, you know, the back of my card says marketing mad scientist, right? So that's the common theme. Whether right. It's cause marketing or traditional marketing, it's a common theme. You know, I think having great teams and being able to delegate is key, right? I'm sort of that crazy guy who comes up with ideas and then gets the teams to execute against them. So, you know, whether I'm coming up with those ideas for clients under DidIt and building new technologies under the DidIt umbrella, like our unique QR codes on every single piece of mail that goes out so that when it's scanned, it pings the CRM and creates what I like to call Glengarry leads. Or if it's, you know, SEO technology or generative engine optimization tech, you know, those are all things that are fun to invent. And I don't code. I've been prohibited from coding by my teams because I tend to go in at 3 a.m. and break things. So I just come up with the ideas. I have teams execute on that. And having amazing teams is really sort of my secret and finding those great people that I can delegate to.
And actually, like one of your secret weapons with the nonprofits is that you find a lot of volunteers to support nonprofits and you're creating win-win opportunities. Like, I'd love to hear how you're creating opportunities for people that are early in their career in marketing and agencies and helping them, you know, get operational experience and getting great causes supported. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we've got the two different nonprofits, Giving Forward, which is a cause marketing focused nonprofit. And then we've got the eMarketing Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of the eMarketing Association. And since the mission of the eMarketing Foundation is, you know, teaching best practices and allowing marketers to become great at what they do, that allows us to bring on volunteers. We've currently sort of discovered that the way the current US immigration system works is for really talented master's degree and sometimes even PhD students, when they finish their studies, they have something called OPT or optional practical training, which is the only way that they can stay in the country is to either get a job or volunteer for a nonprofit. So by having them come in,
or they could marry somebody, but that doesn't sound like a great option these days.
Well, you know, maybe while they're volunteering, they should
Yeah,
date
they
up a
meet
storm,
somebody. That's
right?
right.
So, you
Yeah.
know, we'll make sure
Yeah.
that we keep them busy 9 to 5, and then
Yeah.
from 5 to 9 p.m., you know, maybe they should be dating heavily. I don't have any tricks or tips to give them on the
But
green
hey,
card.
marketing. I hear dating profiles is all about marketing. Not that I know, but
Exactly. They have to learn
I
how to keep.
married. I ma you know, I married already, so I'm very good. I came to the country back in the
Exactly.
days.
So,
So, but yeah,
you
so
know.
you're helping folks that are sort of like want to stay in the U.S. Actually, may be fascinated by the craft of marketing. Whether it's technical or like they need extra drives, like if English is not the, I've actually noticed a lot of marketers for whom English is not their first language that
Yeah.
love marketing. And it's kind of strange. And I don't know if you're seeing this pattern because we've seen this a little bit in our hiring teams at when we were looking at Relate2, also creating kind of an internpreneur program. And there are a lot of folks that, you know, just like they were fascinated by marketing in their second language. And so they had to refine maybe technical skills. But I think there's something about connecting with people and getting the message across when you're struggling that this is not your first language that's really intrinsically important to people. And I don't know if you've noticed that as a pattern for some of your not volunteers that you're working with.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we've got a variety of volunteers. Some of them are getting their master's in either business or one of the, like an MBA. Some of them are getting sort of more data centric degrees, maybe master's in data science or something along those lines. And, you know, luckily we've got enough projects going on that relate specifically to their educational
Right.
objectives that we can find a way to, you know, create a win-win for them. And yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, you know, AI is supposed to be evil, but AI can actually be a little bit of a bridge for these folks, right? Because
Yeah.
they can even describe something in their language and ask for the English version of that, right? And
Yeah.
many of them, you know, between their undergraduate and graduate careers may have actually had jobs overseas with a marketing role, but they don't necessarily understand the context of how to apply it to the US market, right? And
Yeah.
so, you know, AI is actually a tool that they can use.
It's been fascinating. I think AI, you know, if you give the right prompts, like make the copy as funny as Robin Williams, you know, and or whatever it is, the secret that you kind of would outperform a non-AI using native language speaker by a wide margin. And so I think it's sort of creativity. And a little bit of a cultural nuance is really what's needed now. So I do think it's fascinating how the world is opening up. Well, I mean, we'll see what happens with the latest changes in the legal system in the US, but I think but it's great that you're creating these opportunities. And tell us about the foundation and you know kind of I know it's a passion project for you, but so that people learn about the resource and where what they can discover the content
Sure.
that
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the eMarketing Foundation, essentially, because its mission is to, you know, educate marketers on best practices, right? That gives us a fairly wide mandate on the types of projects that we assign, which include projects that might be Giving Forward, which is the cause marketing nonprofit that essentially replaces Amazon Smile, but with partnerships with Walmart and Staples and Priceline and, you know, Kay Jewelers and hundreds of other merchants. And so I don't know that we'll be able to replace 100 million or thereabouts that Smile was generating when they pulled the plug. But that's our mission, is to try to continue to iterate on the cause marketing front. But that's not exclusively what they work on. They work on other projects as well. You know, it all really aligns to, you know, what their focus is. For example, you know, we thought about the fact that there's not really any good directories of nonprofits that have supplemental information about the nonprofits. There are a lot of great nonprofit directories that rate the nonprofits based on efficiency of use of funds or potentially just a taxonomy of the nonprofits, but they tend to fall short in having information about the board members. They tend to fall short of information about, you know, what specific initiatives those nonprofits are doing. So we have one team, for example, of technologists looking at augmenting the IRS data with secondary data sources to try to really create a robust nonprofit directory. And when it's ready, we'll publish that out at the nonprofit registry. So, you know, we have all sorts of fun projects that the teams can work on that are a win-win for them. It really allows them to stretch their responsibilities beyond what they would ordinarily be assigned, you know, in a job environment, to really take ownership of something.
And what are you, when you focus on the broad topic of best practices in marketing, one of the things that strikes me is particularly challenging is to be an expert at everything, right? You have to be, as an agency principal, to be a bit more of a generalist and avoid coding, it sounds like, at night. But in general, it feels quite a challenging task for somebody to stay on top of all the disciplines. The kind of, there's a mythical role of first marketer in a startup that is kind of, I think the answer is like, get a demand gen marketer typically that is good enough to do some other things, but kind of like it has a specialty and probably can't even be good at demand gen at everything at once, but just kind of is able to kind of figure things out quickly. Like, how do you combine small teams with like that much technical complexity that exists in executing, you know, various tactics across various channels efficiently?
I think, you know, for us, what's worked has been having subject matter experts in each of the sort of channels and types of media, right? So in the broad-based categorization, you've got earned media, which includes SEO and digital PR and content marketing, and then starts to bridge into paid media when you think about social, when you think about influencer marketing, because it looks and feels like earned media, but it's really paid media. Then you've got the pure paid media, which is the advertising, you know, Google, all the social media platforms, display, CTV, outdoor advertising, radio, TV, all of that stuff. We still have old school media buyers that buy that other form of media. So having the right subject matter experts in the categories that know more than I do, that's the key, right? I mean, we mail about 30 million pieces of direct mail a year. I don't know the mechanics of how variable digital printing works. Thank goodness my team does. Right. I knew enough about it to invent the Inceptor technology, which puts custom QR codes on every single piece of mail so that when it gets scanned, the mailer knows that the recipient was interested, right? But that's where you take sort of a nerd brain, you take something sort of old school like direct mail and invent something. And, you know, I'm sort of a lifelong learner, right? So I enjoy keeping up with all of the things. I think it's been fascinating for the SEO industry. And I was just at the Brighton SEO conference last week. You know, they're sort of being reinvigorated because now it's generative engine optimization that clients are asking about, which is, how do I show up in Claude and ChatGPT and Gemini, which is a completely different set of algorithms. And so that stuff keeps us fresh, right? Because solving marketing problems is what's the most fun.
Well, it's funny. You're reminding me of one of our other guests, Scott Brinker, who I'm sure you know as the
Scott very well. Yep.
MarTech guru. And, you know, his ever extending list of marketing technology that I think at some point there's some consolidation, but probably not enough type of story. Yeah. and then by the time you consolidate something, a whole new thing like Geo comes in and like breaks everything apart right now. And so like there is this ever present tension between you know, brilliant solutions, right, for specialists, and then ways to integrate all of this. And I know you're in this hotel room in München. Thank you for interrupting your marketing event where you're a speaker and facilitating startup, you know, startup pitches and conversations. So kind of, how do you tell us about, how do you balance the kind of the onslaught of innovation and marketing broadly, you know, I would say broadly just across communications and content, with streamlining things into platforms that at least work end to end, if not by the same platform, but are just deeply connected to get to outcomes?
Yeah, it ties back into that lifelong learning, right? I put myself out there, and I've been able to build it into an agency that's somewhat self-sufficient, except for the fact that I'm out there doing some of the biz dev work, right? Obviously, having intelligent conversations with marketers, learning what all their problems are, and then seeing if we've got, you know, the fit on the internal side, and if not, we hire or acquire, which we made 11 acquisitions in the last 15 years. So that's sort of the focus I've taken. You know, I'm still struggling with the delegation issue, right? Because in addition to running Didit, I've got a nutraceutical company, I've got the e-marketing association, I've got my nonprofit, right? So I've got an incubator, right? So
and I know you have a girlfriend as well. So I think you're like, this is, you're a complete man.
the work-life balance, I don't know if it's a myth or not, but it's a constant, it requires constant effort and energy, right? To find out how to decide what you don't do, right? And what you delegate to others. And that doesn't always work out for the best. I mean, I've had some delegation challenges where I've over-delegated, and realized that while I don't want to be a micromanager, there is a proper place for that pendulum. And finding that proper place depends on the person that you delegate to, right? Yeah. So I think everyone in management probably struggles with that perfect balance. Maybe it doesn't exist, but the best we can do is strive for it.
And in terms of the integrating different systems and different kind of point solutions into one deliverable. Do you feel like this is increasingly a core part of your value prop to some of your small to maybe mid-sized customers, where you know they don't have the bandwidth to mentally even process everything that you have to process? It sounds like it's a challenge for you. You have to stay on top of your toes, I imagine, for a CEO or COO or somebody kind of has CRO who's not really managing marketing, who wants to delegate something and just get a bunch of quality leads. It's even more of a mental challenge to figure out what tactic works and maintain it. Like, do you become in ways like an outsourced chief marketing officer for some of your clients, and where it works and where it doesn't? Like, I would love to hear your take on that.
We do end up there occasionally, but we rarely end up there initially, right? Mm. Because we find that for a CRO or a CMO to basically hand you the keys to their Lamborghini and say, I hope you know how to drive stick because I'm betting on you, right? That's a lot of responsibility for that individual to grant to a team, right? Whether it was an internal team or an external team. So we typically have conversations where we identify the biggest pain point that the individual has, where they have either the weakest link internally, or it's an area where they believe the greatest opportunity lies. And we'll go in there and we'll solve that, right? And so that'll be whichever SME internally is the best at that thing, that will end up being our point person on the Didit team. And then once we crush it for that, you've then built the trust, right? And then that retainer, which may have started out at $7,000, may grow to be 15 or 16 or 18 or 20. You know, our median is in the high teens, but we don't shy away from tackling the problem that the CRO or CMO thinks is their biggest problem, right? Because it may not be their biggest problem, but if it's the one they think is their biggest problem, we don't, rather than start
you
an
need to
argument
prove, you'd
about
rather,
it,
you don't want to argue about it and say, no.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just go fix,
prove,
the problem
prove, fix the problem
they know they have, right?
Right.
And, you know, once you establish that trust, you have a much better land and expand strategy to work with rather than a Trojan horse, to use that analogy.
So you take a bicycle for a spin and then next step.
Yes, and, before the Lamborghini. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're doing that bicycle, what is it that you think defines the initial successful engagement for an agency, where you know you like really level set the expectations? Maybe you already win by the way you're selling it in the first place. So it's even before the engagement, and you know, setting up the KPIs at the time of sale? Is it handholding it and just direct reporting? I think we're really interested because we're starting to work with agencies as our distribution channel. And oftentimes our customers bring in their agency partners sometimes to also, you know, use the, our technology, bring it in. So I'm personally very curious as to, you know, what is the pattern match or what becomes, what's kind of the outline for that super successful initial engagement?
I mean, you mentioned KPIs, and those tend to often be very foundational because there's a temptation in marketing teams or sometimes business development teams to use an oversimplified KPI, which doesn't really reflect long-term profitability, right? And so getting down deep into the data and understanding the difference between someone's average customer and their power customer ends up being really, really key because it changes your KPI. Right. So while ROAS, for example, for an e-commerce client may be a nice intermediate KPI to start optimizing around, LTV is much more valuable because you're going to have a power customer that disproportionately reflects future profitability. Right. So you don't want to treat all your customers equal. Same thing happens in B2B. Right. In B2B, they often are not doing real-time lead scoring. And so they don't know the difference because they're really good lead and a mediocre lead, and they're treating the leads equal, more equal as a CAC or a cost per lead or something, of a dumbed down KPI. So one of the first things we do is we figure out, do they have the back-end business intelligence to at least give us directionally more information about what their best customers look like, as opposed to just an average customer? And often that becomes a huge win, especially in paid media. Paid search, paid social, programmatic, CTV, all those paid media channels, direct mail, right? Knowing what the best customer looks like makes a huge difference because you can find more of those.
Right.
But when you find more of those, that's what moves the needle, not just new customers.
Not just getting some dummy leads that are kind of a bunch of students working for you, you know, like testing that.
You know, it's not just about having the budget, right? It's what... Is this the type of customer that ends up being a long-term win-win, right? Because in the end, whether you're B2C or B2B, no relationship survives if it's not a win-win for both sides, right? So that means the price has to be relative to value, right? Whether you're selling Truth Nutrition Nutraceuticals, which is one of my companies, or you're selling, you know, a SaaS-based software platform, right? Yeah. There needs to be that value exchange.
Well, speaking of that, like, let me share one of my pet peeves in B2B marketing and get your reaction. You probably could guess what it is. So I was very fortunate to actually have one of the founders of the kind of the whole email marketing lead gating industry here, the CEO and founder of Eloqua, on the pod. And, you know, most people in B2B marketing know Marketo. And, you know, tools like HubSpot. And there's this tendency to gate something in the B2B marketing space. There's a lot of evidence that once you gate something, there's a huge drop off of leads. So people don't fill out the gate, but like somebody does get through, you know, give their details. They really want to get that paper and then and the ebook or white paper or whatever is their case study, sometimes the resource. Then they get some notification like, okay, look for an email that you'll need to validate, you know, our subscription or whatnot. So they have to then go click on an email. Then, you know, sometimes they immediately can download a link to a PDF. Sometimes they have to wait again, click something else. Then they get taken... So then they have to leave their email, go into their whatever the PDF reader that they have, like let's say it's Adobe, which is non-web environment, or if they're on their mobile, they're kind of like trying to scroll through that asset, and it's like 30 pages. It's brilliant. Let's say it's brilliant. It's like has real value inside it, but 30 pages is a lot for people to get to the parts that they may care about, certainly on the mobile. And so then they kind of make a mental note to go and, you know, read it sometime when they have the time, because, you know, they can't do this, or like it feels intimidating, and it's gone. And you know, even if they did get through it, there's probably no call to action on that ebook or white paper that we're used to in our website pages that will drive you to actually book a meeting if you're qualified, right? Or go further down the buying channel. Or if there is a particular case study that you want to drill into, like in a conversational study, we could have, I'm asking you questions, like you could almost have the same interaction, ask questions of the asset or drill in, double click on certain things. You know, if you do that, if there's a video link, you kind of click on that video link and then you go to YouTube and, or, you know, maybe Vimeo. Sometimes Vimeo requires you to register to Vimeo to see it. But let's say you go to YouTube, then you see an ad. And like, even if you get through that video, you're off, right? Because you're on YouTube, you'd never come back. You know, you're watching political scary news that we're getting, you know, about New York becoming a communist state, you know, whatever you're watching on your news. And so it feels like we're just putting all these, you know, brakes on the Ferrari that you just kind of been building from that ebook, for actual engagement, you know, getting the lead truly qualified, all the way from just reducing the number of people that are viewing it, but then once they view it, like creating artificial boundaries for, you know, that are kind of basically based on non-modern consumption. And that's like, I would say 80 to 90% of this gated collateral is still like that. Like maybe there's some people doing some online things every now and again, but that they typically run out of steam. They do once in a blue moon and then they stop because it's too time consuming and expensive. That's my observation. So you've been in B2B for a while. Do you see that this is accurate observation of what's happening? Is it changing? Is there a kind of positive trends? And if not, like what's preventing marketers applying what they do elsewhere in this sort of educational content?
Yeah, I think what marketers need to remind themselves, and this is on the B2B side as well, is, you know, you spend all this time in conversion rate optimization removing friction. So arbitrarily adding friction may not have the result that you want. So you're basically saying the person who has the time to bother filling this out is the person I want, when in fact, it may be the opposite. The person who doesn't have the time to fill it out is the most important.
It's the junior assistant to the junior assistant in the mailing department, right?
So
that's going to be reading that.
So
right?
I'm not a huge fan of gating something,
yeah,
unless there's a unique quid pro quo. Like, for example, if a person was a participant in the research and as a result of being a participant in the research got a slightly better, you know, report out of the research because there was a quid pro quo, I can see certain cases where that would be valuable. But even that, I still feel like, first of all, information wants to be free now more than ever, right? Because there's three or four LLMs crawling it. So if you feel like you locked it down and that information is never going to make its way out into the broader ecosystem, you know, we even see situations where, you know, SaaS companies feel like nobody knows their pricing. Come on. I mean, you can usually find out somebody's pricing, even if it's not posted.
You post it on some analyst put it on G2 at some point and it's there.
Exactly. Well, it's somewhere, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I see people gating this content and then like they're forgetting that the way they're hosting it is it's exposed because you could search. Exactly. So we see like all sorts of like, I mean, it's embarrassing, but we look at a lot of marketing PDFs, I guess. I have to say this is... But so you're kind of, you're not a big, huge fan of gating unnecessarily. You're kind of...
Not anymore. I mean, there was a time for the ebook and I'd done that too, right? Having written books and felt like, you know, we sweated out all this effort to create this content. We sort of felt like there should be a quid pro quo to get access to it. But, you know, I've sort of come around to this mode of thinking in B2C and B2B, but in particular in B2B where... You know, focus on the gives and then not the asks, right? And so, because the information wants to be free, because it will probably make its way out there anyway, you end up with a negative branding experience if you make it arbitrarily difficult to get to.
Okay, so that's point one. Not? So point one is gating. And then, as you saw, like in my soliloquy and explaining the problem, I kind of gated. Okay, if all we were doing is gating, okay, but we're doing a lot more than gating. We're then putting an experience that is no longer modern. It's credible. But like, I think there's something about a document that feels downloadable documents feels psychologically credible, which is, I think, one of the reasons why people still like the idea of it. It feels that it's permanent. It's not going to disappear. And so I think there's a win in having belief that you can download something. But at the same time, if you don't read it at the time of when you're most interested, and it's a form factor that feels like it will help you get value quickly, it feels like that's the, you know, almost worse than gating, because it's just like we're saying we're easy to work with, but we're not, right? Like, or we're modern, but we're not. Like, oh, look at what a great design we are. You know, here's a badly designed user experience for learning about how great we are in design. You know, and it's just like it's paradox to me.
Yeah, but I mean, imagine throwing just rudimentary AI at that, right?
Yeah.
Because let's say you've got this 56-page PDF that talks about best practices in something. Yeah. Maybe it's email marketing because it's Marketo or Klaviyo or whatever.
Yeah.
Person downloads it. Of course, the chances that they read it are extremely low. But now you have their PII, right? You have their business identity. You know, it would be trivially easy to build a little AI bot that then applied the best practices of the PDF before it was PDF, when it was still a Word document or a Google Doc, and basically extract out the most relevant things out of that document just for them.
Just for them, based on their LinkedIn and whatever other information.
Exactly. Then say, you know, if you chose to go the route of giving them this substantial PDF that they didn't read, a week later, you could send them a follow-up email and say, by the way, you may not have had a chance to go through and read our PDF, but we extracted the most relevant sectors for you specifically, Alex, because of the business you're in.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it's funny, we find that you can do this in a single document. And I think we also find that sometimes a content hub is another way to bring it together, because not everybody wants to consume a PDF all the time, but like some people have, you know, if you're really interested in something and you want a longer document, you're like in the bottom of the sales cycle, right? Like that's one. And then there's, to get there, you may want to need a string of short form videos, right? And so if you just bring the right short form videos together in one place, that helps. So it feels like that's one of the ways in which we could really create a kind of a journey that takes, here's all the relevant snippets. And if you want to go see the source, and this is really, I'm kind of curious on your view here, because you're building foundations, to me, marketing is really about engaging in actions while building trust. And so oftentimes I feel like it's pretty, like everybody's making a lot of big claims. So trust, there's some value in this longer form assets that they're building trust. There's value in knowing that you could see where this data is coming from, the snippets. You know, how do you see building trust in an age of TikTok and information overload, where like it's almost like they're juxtaposed to each other? And that's something that we're wrestling, like our customers that are really thoughtful about, you know, B2B and the future of B2B, they're trying to combine that, like consumability with compliance, right? Which is kind of crazy, but you kind of need it. Or consumability with trust and showing that you're not afraid to provide the details, but you're also not hiding behind the small print at the same time. What have you seen as some of the most interesting innovation in this, either in B2B or regulated, maybe B2C use cases where you need to comply with providing lots of information?
I think it's actually almost a return to, you know, human authenticity as a subject matter expert to build the trust, right? You know, folks are going to engage with this content via video, maybe via audio. Maybe they'll learn to trust one of us a little bit more as a result of this one.
My mom will love you, Kevin. My mom is like, she's.
but over time, right, the trust builds, right? Because every, you know, the big brands like to think that the person's buying a brand, but they're buying an aggregation of all the people that are behind the brand, whether it's the CRO, the CMO, their evangelist that they hired who used to work at Forrester, right, who's out there cranking out thoughtful content. These folks are all contributing to personal trust building and brand trust building. And it's a long journey, right? So, and it's mid to upper funnel, right? It's not lower funnel. So it's a sort of return to humanity, because AI slop is not going to generate the trust. You know, so those companies that basically say, I'm just going to have an LLM create the content and I'm going to leave the human out of it, you know, that where is the trust being built then? You know, you read through these things and the M dashes are all over the place in the content. Okay, it's possible that the writer used the M dashes. It's nothing against those authors and creators who like M dashes, but we know ChatGPT really likes M dashes. So I think one has to be really judicious when creating content not to use those. Again, there's a journey of trust building that occurs at the individual level and at the brand level, because in the end, people buy from people, right? They don't, they buy from a brand, or okay, maybe at the Salesforce.com site or even Sixth Sense, but even Sixth Sense does a pretty good job. They've got some internal evangelists that are very active out there as thought leaders, less so for Salesforce at this point.
Well, how do you build this trust if you're running a smaller organization, right? Like, so let's agree, Sixth Sense has bigger budgets, been around. Salesforce did its job early. Mark is actually back on the podcast circuit, so it's very very entertaining. And so the challenge I think is the how do you even stand out was this in the world where there's a lot of people starting to do it. Like we're doing it. We're running, you know, relatively small organizations in the larger scheme of things. And I wonder, like, to what degree do you need it to break through the noise, or do you just need it to be there? So when people do check out that this is real, that you kind of like listening to you, people like you, they kind of see you, they could see if somebody's watching, you could see your smile is just authentic, it's real, like you're like, yeah, I get this guy, I want to buy from him. Is that, do you think at the end of the day it's something as simple as that, or it's that plus, you know, really snappy sound bites that we need to go and put into videos? Do we need to like do I need to do some hair job to like look a little different, right? Like, guide me. Like, I mean, I'm doing what's authentic to me, so I'm enjoying this. But I wonder if, like, I do wonder to what degree it's going to be continuing to be effective in a noisy environment where we're competing with B2C noise, for example, as B2B representatives of companies. How do you think about this?
Yeah, I think about it as in layers, right? From you don't need to make noise to everybody. You just have to make noise to those people who would end up being the ones you could help most, right? Mm. And who would help you most, because they have the highest LTV and are willing to perhaps pay a little bit more, right? So you're not trying to boil the ocean, right? Yeah. You're really trying to identify the people who your ICP in B2B language, right? Your ideal customer profile. Where are those people and how do you talk to them? And as it relates to, you know, an individual as a subject matter expert, you know, that's where interesting collabs come up, right? If there are collaborations between, you know, yourselves or myself with one of my hats on and somebody else who's non-competitive or even slightly competitive, right? In the end, my philosophy is let the buyer of something choose, right? I mean, if Didit is not the right choice or Truth Nutrition is not the right choice, then let them find the best match for them. So it opens up collaboration opportunities. It opens up content co-creation. It and then I think about it from a push perspective versus sort of serendipitous discovery, right? Push is great for your email newsletter, your LinkedIn content that you push out, that kind of thing. You're pushing it out there. Simultaneously, a lot of that content, particularly the content that has been generated obviously by a human because it's been transcribed and it exists, you know, and has unique information in it, that's going to end up being ingested by Google, and it's going to be ingested by Bing on the old school side, but it's also going to be ingested by Perplexity and ChatGPT and Claude. So that content ends up being there. If somebody does a fairly niche search, we've now increased the odds that our subject matter expertise will bubble up there, right, and show up in a result.
That's why I think it's increasing. Like I'm noticing the pattern. The more we put out there, the more, the higher the quality of whatever we get back when we do a little. And so, like, even before our meeting, you know, I felt, my brother runs business operations at Perplexity, and so I was kind of using that to say, hey, what, how can we collaborate, right? And so that led to a great discussion and this chat. And so I think part of it is because you're producing a lot of content and we're producing a lot of content, and that actually, you know, allows us to connect the dots that normally may be harder to connect. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think you wanted to talk about geo, like one of the kind of innovation pillars right now that everybody's trying to figure out what's next. You're kind of the SEO OG.
Yes. Started an SEO in 94, which was long before Google existed, and started it in 96, still before Google existed. And, you know, content has remained king the entire time, right? Yeah. But the queen to that king is, where is the content, right? Yeah. And I think that's where GEO comes in really, really heavily, because your content plan isn't just what do I talk about, but where does it live? And you can even see from when you do a search on Perplexity or do a search on ChatGPT, you can see which sources it's querying.
Yeah, right? It doesn't trust everything. It doesn't trust that low value backlink that historically has been your way to trick Google, right?
Well, we never engaged in black hat or gray
Not
hat.
You,
well,
you're mean, our way. You, yeah, industry's
we were
way.
Black hat before it was black hat, when did it was first formed, before there were any rules. But as soon as there were rules, we took the high road. But, you know, my point is really that understanding how important Wikipedia is and when it's important, understanding when Reddit is important, understanding these other places that content sits and how those places will be tiebreakers within certain LLM-powered chatbots, right? Is it a guarantee that if you do this, then you get that? No, it isn't. But the reality is all those things have value in and of itself. Like being active in a Reddit or a subreddit that's relevant to your category, that makes sense, even if it doesn't have LLM implications. You know, being active on LinkedIn makes sense. Creating content on YouTube makes sense. They make sense in a silo. The fact that it bubbles over and creates generative engine optimization value, that's a bonus that may or may not manifest itself to the level that you want. But to not do it because you're like, I'm just giving up, forget it, I'll never show up, I shouldn't do, you know, that's like saying I give up on marketing. No, don't give up on marketing, just do a better job at it.
Don't give up on marketing. Find Kevin Leaf. Kevin, where can people find you, get some more of your nuggets and all of the great causes that you support?
LinkedIn's probably the best way. Various Ventures is the handle, but if you search for for Kevin Lee, you know, I'm one of those in there. So you should be able to find
the handsome one,
Lee.
The handsome, the authentic Kevin Lee. I love
it. So yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn or, you know, a bunch of other places.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for doing all the nonprofit work that you're doing with the foundation and advancing the art and science of marketing.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relato.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to at relate2.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.